This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. The coal ash spill in the Dan River and the cleanup proposals that are dominating the headlines are part of the story. Politicians and policymakers are debating right now the best way to try to get rid of the waste. Environmentalists persist in calls to shut down the ash ponds altogether. The challenge of coal ash disposal is not new, and the issue not limited to our region. A film series screening across the state this month looks at the challenges of coal ash across the country. Rhiannon Feon is a journalist and a filmmaker who's been following the question. Her film, Coal Ash Chronicles, appears at screenings of four documentary films all over the state this month, part of the Coal Ash Stories Tour, and Rhiannon joins us right now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Tell us when and how you, first of all, became interested in the story of coal ash.
Well, you know, I used to work in insurance and went back to school, and about a semester before I graduated from college to become a journalist, I, you know, decided to learn about Twitter, and it was the very first thing that I heard about on Twitter was the TVA coal ash disaster. It happened right before Christmas in 2008. Then I had another semester of school, and as soon as I got out, the EPA released its list of high-hazard coal ash ponds, and I was writing for a weekly near Charlotte called the Mountain Island Monitor. And there were two high-hazard coal ash ponds on the lake. And, you know, I've written about a whole lot of things in the past 5 years, but I keep coming back to coal ash because at some point in all of that, it dawned on me that Mountain Island Lake is the main drinking water reservoir for Charlotte, and it just seemed like a really important story to continue following.
And this project began for you as a book, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I drove from Charlotte to Alaska and all over the United States collecting coal ash stories, and I began filming the interviews really for my own purposes, just so I'd get the quotes right and have a little context, that kind of thing. And when I got back to Charlotte, I started looking at them and realized that, you know, these people really need to be seen and heard. You know, they need, you know, I'm a decent writer, but they're so emotional, some of them. And I'm not talking about just the citizens who are sick or have property damage, but also the people, you know, in industry and academia and government who have been working on coal ash issues for years and sometimes even decades. And so documentary was kind of born accidentally.
Well, and for instance, you talked with one woman in Fairbanks, Alaska about her experience living near a coal ash pond. Let's listen.
Living across from the power plant or in real close proximity to it is not a pleasant thing. Not at all. It's just dirty. It's black, it's dirty, it stinks. And then you add the dump trucks. I would see the dust fly off of the things. It's like they're driving down the street and you know, I'd see that dust flying out of the back of the dump truck. And I just thought, that can't be good. If it's coming into your house, you're wearing it, you're breathing it, you're eating it, you're drinking it.
And there's a clip from Coal Ash Chronicles, and producer Rhiannon Feon is on the line with me right now. So is it just a nuisance? Is it just dirty, nasty, and smelly? What else is the problem with this stuff?
Well, you know, I really think when we get to the very bottom of it, what we have is an issue of old technology versus new technology. I mean, it's a very human thing to throw trash in your backyard and walk away and hope that it just disappears. We've been doing that since the dawn of humanity. Only with this stuff, you know, what you end up with are heavily concentrated pits of, you know, up to a third of the periodic table, and that includes heavy metals and radioactive elements. And those things are exposed to the elements, and they, you know, they leak, they drain into our drinking water. So that's the old technology. The new technology would be the things that, like, industry and academia are working on to find ways to take the coal ash and repurpose it in ways where it's encapsulated, and that would be, like, the concrete and asphalt. And even paint and a whole bunch of products can be made with coal ash. So, you know, that's kind of the wave of the future, so to speak. And I heard in your previous segment you were talking about the difference between cleanup and closing. You know, to the people in the beneficial reuse industry, if you just close these ponds, you know, cover them with dirt and grass and walk away from them, that's the equivalent of throwing away a resource that they really want to use to put in other products. And there have been some studies done, one by Tufts University, University that indicates that should coal ash be regulated and beneficial reuse made more prevalent, tens of thousands of jobs could be created. So it's kind of a battle of wills right now between old technology that would just be concerning because of infrastructure concerns, that's aging and et cetera, versus, these people who are really trying to do something with this stuff.
Well, and a battle between the way, the way the accounting is done, because, if you're Duke
sure.
Energy, you're talking about $10 billion in cost, and then cost. And then, of course, if you're using the utility, right, if you're an electric user, then you say, well, don't pass that on to me. But as you point out, one man's cost is another man's paycheck. And so the idea that this could be reused, that $10 billion could actually be a resource and sold to industries that are looking for this stuff, becomes a much more creative way of doing it if you take a kind of more global approach rather than what's going to happen to my electric bill.
Right. And one cost that's not brought up very often is when the EPA released its proposed regulation back in, I think it was 2010, in there they indicated that $290 billion a year would be saved in health care costs per year. So when you start comparing, $10 million, $10 billion over 30 years versus $290 billion annually, I mean, that's, kind of a no-brainer there.
Well, again, that's an accounting problem because if you're Duke mm-hmm. Energy, what you just described to me is not a cost to me at all. That's called an externality, and society bears that. They've socialized that cost. So, no, don't
right.
talk to me about that sounds like a personal problem to Duke Energy. So, again, until you take a global approach and policymakers say to themselves, we're all paying this, and even if Duke Energy doesn't want to, that becomes kind of the problem, isn't it, in sort of finding solutions to this, just the way we do the accounting.
Well, yeah, I agree. I mean, they're in the business of making money. But if we look back at the history of the coal ash situation, back in the 1950s, pre-EPA, pre-NC Department of Environment and Natural Resources, pre-Clean Air Act, pre-Clean Water Act, it was a decision made by the coal industry to begin watering down their ash and putting it in these ponds in an effort to keep the ash from getting into the air. So, I mean, it is not unprecedented for these companies to do something that's somewhat altruistic, that benefits the community. And I think, Duke Energy is such a leader in North Carolina, especially. I think people kind of expected them to do that in this situation, too. So it's kind of interesting to watch it all play out. They're one of the biggest lobbyists in Washington, D.C., too. I mean, you mentioned before, this is not just a North Carolina issue. This isn't even just an America issue. This is a worldwide issue. And Duke Energy is the largest energy provider in the United States and in the world. And if they were to do something about coal ash, I think that it would have positive ripple effects around the world, actually.
And this is, of course, not the only spill in the world. Recent. Tell us about some of the other major spills that you've investigated or that you researched. Obviously, we've known about them, but tell us about them.
Well, sure. And it's not just spills that are of concern, but, of course, the TVA disaster in 2008, they had an earthen dam that basically liquefied, and it covered over 300 acres with 1.1 billion gallons of coal ash. I mean, it knocked houses off of their foundation. It uprooted railroad. And 6 years later, it's still not completely cleaned up. So that's a major one. There have also been smaller ones, like down in Wilmington. There was a small breach where a employee's truck fell into the hole, the breach in the dam. There have been situations where employees have actually, accidentally run into the things and been lost forever, them and their equipment. I mean, it's not, we think of ponds and that seems somewhat innocuous, but these are pits of waste matter, and that's how they should be considered. So when something falls into it, your chances of getting them back out are nil. But, it's not just the ponds, like I said. For instance, up in Alaska, they don't have the ponds for obvious reasons. They would freeze and burst. The coal ash is also being used for backfill, which is a big problem up there. It's being used as grit on roads during icy weather conditions, etc. So, I mean, it's not just these ponds that are of concern, but the ponds are of a huge concern. Many of them are made, like I say, with these earthen dams, and they're just, they're getting old. And just like a lot of other infrastructure in the country, we need to be aware of the fact that it's aging and that we need to do something to monitor it and maintain it.
And you talked about the fact that this ash contains a third of the periodic table, heavy metals included. What do we know about the potential health risks of coal ash?
Well, yeah, on our website, coalashchronicles.com, I have linked to the government information about which each of these elements or what these elements can do to the human body and where you can come into contact with them, etc. So we know a good deal about each individual element. What we don't really understand is how these elements work together, how they're affected by the weather, you know, and just over time what happens. That's just a big gap in our information. So the health problems can range from lower IQs in children, birth defects, cancer, Alzheimer's, you know, cardiovascular disease. I mean, it really runs the spectrum. The problem is that not only do we not know enough about these what happens in these ponds chemically, it's very, very, very difficult to point at them and say, yes, for sure, this is what caused my cancer or Alzheimer's or whatever. And that's in, you know, large part because there are just so many carcinogens and chemicals in our environment. But so I can tell you that, you know, this, you know, arsenic causes cancer, but I can't, and I can tell you that, like, at Mountain Island Lake in Charlotte, 1 to 3 pounds of arsenic is entering the lake daily, or at least it was a couple of years ago. But I cannot, you know, point to that and say, this is why my friend had bladder cancer or something like that. It's just really difficult to make that connection.
And, of course, people in these communities are often convinced that this is the cause. How are these communities around coal ash ponds, around the nation, responding? What are they doing about it?
You know, it depends on the area. I'm in Alabama right now. I recently followed up on a story here in Perry County. It's one of the poorest counties in the United States. It's where the TVA disaster coal ash was shipped. You know, these people, a lot of them are illiterate. Most of them don't have internet access. They had no idea, you know, what was going on when all this stuff was being shipped to them. And they're pretty outraged about it. But unfortunately, they don't have the means to really fight back. So there's that. Then you look at the town of Pines, Indiana, where there's a coal ash landfill that's contaminated drinking water. The company paid to put a lot of the town on city water. And for the rest of the people, for a dozen years, they've been paying for them to have bottled water in their homes. You know, then you look up in Alaska, where the main woman that you see in our trailer who's fighting back, she's now suing the EPA with a few others. But for the most part, she's being harassed because she's speaking out. So, I mean, it really, again, coal ash is such a huge issue with so many tentacles. It's the same thing with these communities. Some communities are very activated. You know, they've been activated for years, and some communities are still like, well, I don't even know what this stuff is. So,
well, tell us more about Perry County. I think that's a fascinating story, both in terms of where that site is, the people who live around it, and the fact that the state and county actively recruited the coal ash into their state. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, they sure did. And so the county got some money from it, and ADEC, that would be the Alabama Department of Environmental, I forget what the C is for, conservation, I think. But so the county and the state both received money from this, and there were all these promises that, you know, they would make the schools better and infrastructure better, et cetera. But that's not what happened. And that's infuriating on itself or by itself. But when you look at the 1,600-acre landfill, two sides of it have residents living next to it and two sides don't. They decided to put that coal ash literally right across the street from residents. I was standing in one of their driveways the other day, and literally it is a huge mountain of trash. And now because of this, they're accepting all kinds of other waste from other states. They're mixing it in with the coal ash. They're now having to flare off methane. I mean, it's become a huge nuisance for these people who are now concerned about the health of their children, and rightfully so.
And once again, the demographic profile of those people who are now neighbors to this coal ash, in terms of wealth, in terms of perhaps people of color, let me guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's majority African American, and it's, like I say, it's one of the poorest counties in the United States. And, you know, even though a lot of environmental groups had been down there before I first arrived, you know, I sat with one woman in her living room and I said, has anyone ever actually explained to you what is in this stuff? And she said, no, I just know that it's bad. Mm. You know, and I said, well, you can look it up online. And she said, well, we don't have the internet here. So, I mean, it's just, they're just really uninformed in large part because of their poverty.
We are talking about the documentary film The Coal Ash Chronicles on the state of things. Filmmaker Rhiannon Fionn is with me. And so Rhiannon, tell us about the EPA. Where do they stand? What do they say they know and what do they say should be done about coal ash?
Well, you know, the EPA has been working on coal ash regulations for more than 30 years now. You know, this is not new news to them. And, you know, the beneficial reuse of coal ash has been happening for more than 30 years. And it seems like the EPA is supportive of certain types of beneficial reuses, and that would be where it's encapsulated in concrete, asphalt, etc. But they have never actually finalized their regulation. Back in 2010, I believe it was, they issued two options. They went on a, like, basically a town hall tour to eight cities around the country and collected about 500,000 public comments, but they still have never actually finalized their rule. They are now supposed to finalize their rule by December 19th of this year. So, you know, in talking with a whole lot of people, you know, the expectation is that they're not going to classify coal ash as a hazardous waste and that they will approve of certain types of beneficial reuse. Now, the types that they probably will not you know, approve of, and again, this is, you know, speculation since it hasn't happened yet, but would be using coal ash to stuff mines, basically, which is a type of mine reclamation, or using it on roads as road grit or as backfill in areas where it's unlined, that type of thing. So the EPA is somewhat mum about it. I mean, you know, people in journalism know that it's really hard to get the EPA to talk to them.
Well, let me just talk about those two uses, stuffing mines and spreading it on roads. I mean, obviously, you've not really done much to ameliorate the hazard. They're still in the ground or on the surface, and they're going to probably make their way back into the water table, right?
That's it. Exactly what the concern is. You know, as soon as that ice melts, it runs right off. You know, coal ash, especially fly, there are many different types of coal ash. The fly ash is the really, really light, powdery stuff. It's almost like a talc. It's so light. So once it's dry, it can easily fly away. So both the runoff with water and the wind carrying it off are the concerns for unencapsulated so-called beneficial reuses.
Now, your film is one of several films that's on tour here in North Carolina about coal ash. In fact, yours is a work in progress. It's an extended trailer. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. And we really just wanted to focus on the citizens with this one. But yeah, we hope to have the film finished by September and premiering in film festivals by January.
All right. And so among the people you've talked, and of course, part of the what you've discovered is that people in these communities have various solutions, but I'm suspecting they feel a little alone and in isolation in their struggle to get some kind of satisfaction.
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely a common thread that I see all throughout the country. And people really do believe that their government is looking out for them. So people will first go to their local government, then county, then state, then federal. And, you know, kind of the overriding theme here is that people in the end feel like their government's not protecting them at all and is instead protecting big industry. And it's kind of hard to argue that with some of the non-action that's happened.
All right, Rhiannon, thank you so much for talking with us.
Sure, thank you so much.
Rhiannon Fionn is a journalist and filmmaker. Her work, Coal Ash Chronicles, is one of four films that appears as part of the Coal Ash Stories Tour. It's sponsored by several organizations, including Appalachian Voice, Earth Justice, North Carolina Conservation Network, NC Warn, the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy and Working Films. Screenings take place tomorrow night in Asheville, Greensboro, Raleigh, and Wilmington. Details on our website, as is the extended trailer. So if you go to stateofthings.org, you can see details about the screenings and the extended trailer. Just ahead, tracing our collective history through the eyes of a classic car. Stay tuned.